Okay. Yesterday, we were bridging the gap from the synoptic problem into the historical Jesus by giving more of a historical perspective on what was happening during the time period that all these theories were being articulated, as well as what we'll find here in the historical Jesus. The time period is really the emergence, or the time period shortly after the emergence of modernity. But modernity is birthed not out of a time period of tranquility. It's birthed out of a time period of crisis. A crisis that develops an anxiety. An anxiety there, or the Cartesian anxiety, where they feel a tension between, between absolute chaos and absolute certainty. And in the minds of modernists, or people that are influenced by modernity, which we are, these are the only two options: absolute chaos, absolute certainty. And as a result, different movements began in order to try to figure out how to rescue us out of absolute chaos and solidify absolute certainty. So you had empiricism, which is looking at all the sensory things as the foundation from which they will construct absolute certainty. And then you have rationalism, utilizing, you know, thinking itself as the foundation upon which absolute certainty will be developed. And then I started to list key tenets of modernity. And yesterday, the first one I listed was the exaltation of reason, where objective truth really becomes worshipped. The center of modernity, you are worshiping objective truth. And objective truth, sometimes that can be almost morphed together into one word. You need to see it as two separate words to understand what they're going after. Objective, meaning above any context, which that even movement itself as somebody that is influenced by postmodernity is a difficult move for me to make. Why? Because postmodernity is very keenly aware that we are contextualized beings. But we'll get to that in a bit. But objective, to move beyond any context, to tap into something that is contextualist. Objective, and then truth, so this concept or this idea that is overarching, that becomes the center of modernity. So key tenets of modernity: exaltation of reason or worship of objective truth. Hyper-skepticism becomes another key tenet of modernity. Hyper-skepticism, like an intensified distrust, where modernity's primary methodology is driven by distrust, skepticism towards all authorities. Now, that makes sense whenever you understand the history of where modernity came out of. Why are they distrusting of everything? Because it's all the authorities, whether we're talking economic authorities, political authorities, religious authorities, even in some sense, the climate itself, the authority of nature, is distrusted because in the trust of those authorities, it led to chaos. So you distrust so that hopefully you can delineate out what leads you to chaos and what leads you to absolute certainty. So hyper-skepticism is a central methodological component. It's more reactionary than it is proactive. Number three, third key tenet of modernity: hyper-categorization or a hyper-compartmentalization. They are constantly categorizing. What is a categorization? Well, it's a means of gaining control over something by putting it in a box. It's even really the motivation that we have behind stereotyping. Why do you stereotype something or someone? It's because you're usually afraid of it. And whenever you're afraid of it, you need to figure out a way to gain control of it. And the way you gain control of it is by putting it into a box that then you can handle, that you can deal with. But that's what you have in modernity. So you have dichotomies coming up everywhere: the public sphere versus the private sphere, the natural versus the supernatural, science versus religion. Compartments, dichotomies, becomes a means by which they're able to develop some sort of foundations or foundationalism in some sense. And then fourth key tenet: shift to human-centered. Modernity is human-centered. All of this can be accomplished through the individual's ability to come to an objective conclusion through their disciplined, objective perspective. We can do this. Matter of fact, I mean, you even see some of this in the principles of interpretation that we utilize here at the school. What's the point? Divorce yourself from yourself so that you can come to the text without any presuppositions or assumptions that would influence the way in which you engage it. That's romantic. Whether or not it's possible is something I would challenge. But for a modernist, that is the goal. You come to everything with this perspective of objectivity, which is the reason why recently a lot of the biases of news stations has become a big topic of conversation. Because for modernists, there is nothing more betraying than to insert yourself whenever you're trying to just merely report facts. You should not insert yourself. Why? You should be objective in giving the facts. And so there's this war. You'll even see this war between some of the older journalists and now the newer journalists, and the way in which the older journalists are saying you are destroying journalism. Why? Because of your subjective perspective. Now, there's an assumption in that. The assumption is the older journalists were objective. They divorced themselves from the facts sufficiently enough to be able to give the facts sterilely. You see that movement? And that we can accomplish this by merely figuring out the way, by, as humans, we can accomplish this by figuring out a way to become purely objective. So you'll hear people even say stuff like this. Yeah, the problem is with that person is they just get too emotional. Whenever they're looking at the situation, they get too emotional. What are they saying? They're not objective. That's what they're saying. And what's also being said is, therefore, they are not able to be clear. Therefore, they are not able to get to the true situation or the true perspective. You see all those? Those are all underlined. And it's so interwoven into who we are that it will just slip into comments or into thought patterns and we don't even know it. Because, again, modernism is not just an idea. It's a measurement of societal norms. This is what us as a society has been functioning off of for the past 400 years, 500 years. This is why post-modernity, people are freaked out about it. Is because post-modernity, on some sense, is challenging some of these key tenets. Irony of post-modernity is, post-modernity has become skeptical of the hyper-skepticism of modernity. It's using the methodology of modernity to actually turn on modernity. But for the modernists, that's a big problem. Does that make sense? You seeing how this is? Now, this is the setting within which the historical Jesus movement is even born. And you will see the reason why this is so important to get these categories in place is as we start marching through the major figures of historical Jesus, you will see these key tenets being what is driving the ship. It's really, what we're going to be doing is looking at the lens with, at the very beginning of the class, I said what we're going to do in this class is we're going to take the Gospels and put a different lens on them. And every time you put a different lens on it, you see something totally new. On some sense, what we're doing is we're tracing the lens of modernity. This is the natural consequence of having the lens of modernity put onto the Gospels, and what do we get? The answer is the quest of the historical Jesus. Herman Ramirez is the first name we're going to want to engage. Herman, double N, he's German. Ramirez. Herman Ramirez. I'll put some dates up there so that way you also can see how it is parallel. Remember, I told you modernity is really exploding into the 1500s, beginning of the 1600s. So once that really starts to take shape over 100 years or so, you start to see how it is infiltrating other areas, specifically gospel studies, which is why we're in a really fascinating time. If Phyllis Tickle is correct, and we're in another 500-year upheaval, what you're really going to start to see is the fruits of this upheaval won't really impact a lot of some of the key terrain for another about 40 years. So in your lifetime, you'll start to see the new patterns laid down that will impact the church and the world for the next 300 to 400 years, which is interesting. I mean, if Jesus decides not to come back. But Herman Ramirez is considered the father of the quest. The father of the quest. He was a professor of Semitic languages in Germany. in Deutschland. Semitic languages. So you're talking, you know, Hebrew, Aramaic, Semitic languages. And what I want to do is I want to summarize his teachings by giving five key things that he says. So we're going to just summarize what he says with five key points, okay? So hopefully that will be able to make this digestible of what he is contributing. Number one, what Ramirez teaches is, what he teaches, that was a really weird way of saying that. What Ramirez's teaching suggests or something, I don't know, is number one, he separates the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. He separates the Jesus of faith over here in this compartment, notice the modernist tendency, and the Jesus of history over here, as if what we have in the Gospels is a Jesus of faith that should be separated from the actual Jesus of history. So you see what he's doing? Compartmentalizing, which is a modernist tendency or a modernist tenet. Separates the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. Specifically, he labels Jesus as, and this is number two, a Jewish Jesus. For Ramirez, Jesus was, quote, he was born a Jew and intended to remain one. And that's the end of the quote. Until the Christians hijacked him for their own theology. So for Ramirez, Jesus was Jewish. He meant to be, he was born a Jew, meant to stay a Jew, but then after he dies, the Christians hijack him for their own reasons, for their own agendas. Jesus of faith, Jesus of history. Then you, he says, well, the Jesus of history was Jewish. Number three, this Jesus came to establish a Jewish kingdom. So he says, Jesus came to establish a Jewish kingdom. And in fact, what he meant by he came to establish a Jewish kingdom is that Jesus came to establish the political kingdom that we would expect of a Jewish leader to establish, a Judas Maccabeus type kingdom with violence and military force, toppling the heads of the enemies, exalting the nation of Israel, stuff we've already talked about, right? When we looked at the messianic expectations, he says that's exactly what Jesus came to do, to establish a Jewish kingdom through military force, not some heavenly kingdom. Yeah.
What was Hermes' religion?
What's that?
What was his religion?
I mean, he was a Christian scholar. I don't know if I'm really comfortable with going much beyond that, but he would have been considered Christian. Yeah. But he was a professor of Semitic languages. Yeah. Number four, Ramirez's conclusion about the Jesus of history. So this is his. This is another summary of his teaching. This is his conclusion. Okay, we ready? Ramirez believed that the real Jesus of history was a wannabe Messiah. That he attempted to establish a political kingdom in Jerusalem through violent force, like a Messiah would, but his plans were overthrown when he was arrested and crucified. He believes that his conclusion of the Jesus of history is that the Jesus of history was a wannabe Messiah that failed. That was his conclusion. So in a sense, like affirming the crucifixion, but for different reasons than it wasn't his goal. It was an unfortunate ending to a political coup. Okay? And then number five, this is his conclusion of the Jesus of faith. The disciples were not satisfied with letting all of the riches and glory that were promised to them to just simply disappear with Jesus' death. And so they fabricated the resurrection and developed the Jesus of faith to secure power and dignity for themselves. Do you hear what he's saying? The Jesus of faith was a fabrication for the disciples to retain the glory they felt were promised to them in Jesus' life. So the Jesus of faith is a fabrication of the disciples so that they can retain some of the glory they felt was owed to them, promised to them in Jesus' life and ministry. Okay? So this is Ramirez's teaching. Now, this was not published during Ramirez's life. As a matter of fact, after his death, his daughter was cleaning out his office and found manuscripts for a book that gave these teachings that was inside of his desk drawers. And so she took those and gave them to one of his friends named Gotthold Lessing, which if you know anything about this time period, that was a kind of a big shot in the academic world. And he published these anonymously over the next 4 to 5 years. So these weren't published until around 1774 through 1778, anonymously. Now, eventually people found out it was Ramirez, and that's how he became the father of the quest. But he didn't intend to be the father of a quest, especially in his lifetime, because he felt it was just too radical what he was saying. He felt it wouldn't be received. It could threaten his job or threaten his family. So what are Ramirez's lasting impacts? That's what we're going to do for especially these first couple. I'm going to give you the teachings, and then I'm going to give you what is their lasting impact. The lasting impacts are stuff that even resonates into today. So you're talking almost 300 years later. Ramirez's lasting impact, number one, is the distinction between the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. That is still something, even once we move into the third quest and beyond, that still the distinction between a Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history is something that is virtually unquestioned as a presupposition, that of course there is a separation between the two, that there is a distinction between the Jesus of faith, Jesus of history. Okay? And number two, Ramirez's lasting impact was his Jewish eschatology. Even today, people rage and debate over how much Jesus embraced the views of a first century Jewish apocalyptic eschatology. That he came as an apocalyptic prophet, proclaiming the end of something and the beginning of something, and it was Jewish in its orientation. That is an assumption. Everybody looks at Jesus as Jewish and an eschatological figure, the end of something and the beginning of something. And that's something that Ramirez locks into place for 200 to 300 years. The question is just how much does he embrace? It's not does he embrace it at all. It's how much does he embrace it? You understand how that makes sense? Follow me? Holla if you hear me. You guys are doing good? Okay. So that's Ramirez. Next figure that comes on the scene. Oh, I was doing it in red. It's all the way over there. We're going green. Is David, now he's still German, just give him a minute. F. Strauss. Strauss, that's a U, I promise. David F. Strauss from 1808. To 74. 1808 to 1874. Strauss's major contribution is his introduction to the concept of myth into the equation. So let me summarize his teachings with three things, all of which surround this concept of myth. Teaching number one is the introduction of myth. Summary of his teaching, point one, introduction of myth. His major point of contention is to say that this interpretation of the Gospels that's separating the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith by using naturalistic explanations to interpret stuff like the miracles and, in a sense, explaining it away like a lot of the deists would have done. He says you're destroying or disregarding the impact of myth on ancient cultures. You're just not paying attention to it. So, number two, he says what we have to do is have myth be a central component of our study of the historical Jesus. Myth is centralized for Strauss. Myth is centralized. Strauss suggests that the major advantage of his myth approach is that it, quote, leaves the substance of the narrative unassailed, and instead of venturing to explain the details, accepts the whole not indeed as true history, but as a sacred legend. So he says, I don't see the purpose of going into these documents and ripping away what is faith and what isn't, what is myth and what isn't. He says, as a matter of fact, you should allow it to be unassailed. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't peer below the surface. It's just that in digging below the surface for the historical Jesus, we shouldn't destroy what it is that we have. You see what he's saying? Keep it intact by understanding what it is. Here's his third movement. It is important, though, if you are studying myth, to understand, number three, the source of the myth. Where is the source of the myth? Where does the myth come from? And he would argue that the early Christians utilized Old Testament stories to develop the myth of the historical Jesus. So they use the source of the myth is the Old Testament. If you understand the Old Testament documents, you understand the layer the Christians put over the historical Jesus, which allows you then to keep the Gospels intact and to see below the surface. So what he does is by utilizing, some methodologies that will eventually develop here. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is the fourth conclusion. He concludes that Jesus... That's not a conclusion. I call it a conclusion. Don't write that down in your notes. Yeah, that's dumb. Yeah, he establishes some bare facts about the historical Jesus that pretty much look a lot like Ramirez. He just gets there in a different route. Okay, so we're going to keep moving. So what's Strauss's lasting impact? That's what I want us to talk about. Number one, lasting impact. This is the beginnings of form criticism. This is where form criticism will eventually develop by looking at what is the top layer, where is the source of the myth, and what happens when we engage that. You'll see this become very important and quite influential in the second quest with Rudolf Bultmann, but we'll get there in like 10 minutes. So the beginnings of form criticism. Number two, lasting impact of Strauss's work is, and now I'm going to give a title and we're going to do two sub-points. The reactions to Strauss are some of his lasting impact. Impact is the reactions to his work. Reaction number one, you have some people that overemphasize myth. Some people respond to Strauss's work by just diving into it as deep as they can go, and they overemphasize myth to the point where a guy by the name of Bruno Bauer, you don't need to know his name, but suggested that all of the gospel's myth, nothing was history, Jesus was a complete fabrication. He didn't even exist, ever. So you have some people that take Strauss's work and move it all the way to the furthest extreme, overemphasizing myth, which irony is at this point, if you understand what a myth is at all, you would realize there was always a historical kernel somewhere that's actually the way in which myths even develop, but that's a René Girard conversation for a different time. Bruno Bauer, though, is one of the ones, takes it too far. Number two, reaction to Strauss's work, you see the emergence of the two-source theory. In response to Strauss, the emergence of the two-source theory. What is the two-source theory? I'm going to map it as you describe it. What is it? We have Q. Where do I put Matthew? Over here, where at? Bottom. Mark at the top. Luke at the bottom. Where do I put my arrows from Mark? Good. And then Q? Good. Two-source theory. Now here's why this develops during this time. When some people are overemphasizing myth, what you do is you have a group of scholars that say, now wait a minute. There is something historical about the New Testament. So how do we get to what is historical? How do we get to what it is that actually happened? And what they do is they begin by looking at Mark in priority and begin delineating out where it is that all the material comes so that we can have a historical foundation upon which we can see the development of more myth-laden texts. As a matter of fact, one of the motivations of starting with Mark is the fact that it does not have what they would term an embarrassing infancy narrative. These two have virgin births. This one doesn't. So they look at this one as immediately saying, see, at the very beginning, Mark postures itself as a more historical document because it's not beginning with this mythic type birth. You see their motivation. Now, it's ironic that the two-source theory is actually a conservative response to a liberal movement of making the entire Gospels mythic. Because that's not how we treat this theory today. We treat it as a bastion of liberalism and evil, which is, to me, overstated. Does that make sense? So Strauss's work, you have some people that say, we're going to take this as far as we can with the myth, and you have other people responding by trying to preserve the historicity of the Bible through the two-source theory. Okay? Is this making sense? Follow me? You guys are actually really attentive today. Well done. This is grand. We're finishing strong. Yes. Okay. This conclusion, let me say this. Let me summarize it by saying, primarily, utilizing the development of the two-source theory, the historical Jesus movement progressed positively for the next several years. The responses to Strauss, you see them actually making some interesting discoveries. They have from this foundation, they have a historical Jesus that was a good moral reformer, is what they saw him as. He was a good man who was a moral reformer who taught a reasonable, love-based religion. These are some of the core facts of the historical Jesus that they come to. Because, and they were able to see this now, because he was freed from his miracles and his claims of divinity. Once you free him from those, you can see who he is according to the historical Jesus movement. He was a good moral reformer who taught reasonable, love-based religion. Now, I would question the word reasonable in that sentence, but because if it was so reasonable, then why was he hanging on a tree? But that's a whole other issue. And this conclusion was considered a major victory. A major victory. We have figured out something about the historical Jesus. So there's a lot of optimism about where this could lead and about what else that we could establish. The optimism, though, comes to a grinding halt at the turn of the 20th century with two figures. The first one is a guy by the name of William Redd. You're going to want to look at how to spell the name Redd. William Redd, who lives from 1859 to 1906. And the second figure that we will look at is Albert Schweitzer. W. Schweitzer, who, let's see, 1875 to 1965. These two, in some sense, accidentally kill the first quest of the historical Jesus. They don't really intend to. It's just that the work that they produce, the result is the historical Jesus movement comes to an end. So William Redd, can you guys see it? Some of you are moving your heads as if you can't. William Redd and Albert Schweitzer. In 1901, William Redd publishes an article, an essay, entitled The Messianic Secret in the Gospel of Mark. William Redd, 1901, publishes an essay, The Messianic Secret in the Gospel of Mark. And what he argues is that you can trace the messianic secret throughout the Gospel of Mark, and what it shows is that there is literary developments post-Easter. Literary developments post-Easter in the Gospel. Why is that a problem? For the historical Jesus movement, why is it a problem to find literary technique or literary development in the Gospel of Mark? Why would that be a problem? Okay, so the last part of the gospel we have set apart on some level. But if there is literary development inside of the Gospel of Mark and you are a strict modernist, what is now threatened? There is an ivity word. It's objectivity. Right? Because what it shows is, if there's literary development post-Easter, what it shows is that the author has inserted himself into the sterile historical facts. It's not just Mark giving us sterile history. These are the facts, I'm just telling you what they are. No, it's Mark taking what happens and literally developing it through a messianic secret motif that ends powerfully with this messianic secret where the women run away afraid, telling no one. If there is literary development, then all of a sudden, one of the key pillars of our two-source theory that retained history is now shattered. You see why this is a problem for a modernist. Notice, all of those modernist categories we put down are what it is that's being attacked here. Because if one of your key tenet is, or what do you, if you worship, or the exaltation of reason, but you worship objective truth, and now all of a sudden you realize that one of your key sources is no longer objective, and one of your other sources at this point doesn't exist, what do you have left in order to get to the historical Jesus? Answer would be nothing. So William Redd's merely just saying, hey, just notice something. It's called the messianic secret motif. Noticed it in the Gospel of Mark, thought I'd write about it. The problem is it shatters one of the key foundational pillars of the historical Jesus movement as it is. Albert Schweitzer then comes along, and in 1906, he writes a book entitled The Quest of the Historical Jesus. And the whole point of the book is to merely chronicle history. All he does is he traces the movement from Ramirez all the way to William Redd. And he just says, let's just look at the last 200 years or so of this quest of the historical Jesus and see what's happened. In doing this, it actually exposes the quest of the historical Jesus in a way that Schweitzer didn't necessarily mean to. He was being honest. He was articulating what is, but his goal wasn't to destroy the quest, although in effect, that's what the book does. What Schweitzer shows is that what a lot of the times you find is the people that are leading the quest, like a Ramirez, a lot of times what you find is that you find them, their reflection in what it is that they find in Jesus. So he says, Ramirez comes along and this is the way he describes Jesus. And interestingly enough, it looks a lot like Ramirez. So what is he inserting? What is he showing by tracing all of the conclusions of the people in the historical Jesus? That they're not objective. In other words, matter of fact, after 200 years, what Schweitzer's showing is maybe objectivity isn't even possible when you're in pursuit of an objective historical Jesus. Which is an observation that, frankly, was ahead of its time. But again, it wasn't something that he thought should be death-blowing, even though it turns out to be something that shatters it. So what he says basically is we're not just fighting against the agendas of the writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We're fighting against the agendas of the interpreters, Ramirez, Redd, Strauss. He, though, Schweitzer says, but I think there's a way that we can still pull together some details. It's not as if the historical Jesus is completely irrecoverable. It's not as if we can't know anything about him. We can, is what Schweitzer would say. Specifically, Schweitzer concludes, similar to Ramirez, that Jesus was a failed Jewish apocalyptic prophet. He's a failed Jewish apocalyptic prophet that predicted the end of the world, but it never came. So Schweitzer, in chronicling what it is that's happened, does give his opinion. He says, listen, even though we are deceiving ourselves into an objectivity when in reality there's clearly a subjectivity, it doesn't mean we can accomplish nothing. It doesn't mean we can't recover any details of the historical Jesus. And Schweitzer says, from what I can see, the historical Jesus is a failed Jewish apocalyptic prophet that predicted the end of the world. It just never came. As a matter of fact, let me read you this portion at the end, the conclusion, towards the conclusion of Schweitzer's book. He says, there is silence all around. The Baptist appears and cries, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Soon after that comes Jesus, and in the knowledge that he is the coming Son of Man, lays hold of the wheel of the world to set it moving on the last revolution, which is to bring all ordinary history to a close. It refuses to turn, and so he throws himself upon it. Then it does turn and crushes him. Instead of bringing in the eschatological conditions, he has destroyed them. The wheel rolls onward, and the mangled body of the one immeasurably great man, who was strong enough to think of himself as the spiritual ruler of mankind and to bend history to his purpose, is still hanging upon the wheel. That is his victory, and that is his reign. So that's Schweitzer's historical Jesus. This failure for Schweitzer, though, doesn't seem for him to denigrate the legacy of Jesus. He doesn't see that as a negative. As a matter of fact, what Schweitzer concludes is that once we get rid of all of the outdated Jewish theology that was superimposed onto Jesus, we are able to embrace the message of love that Jesus perpetuates. I mean, I will be honest with you. One of the things that's pretty startling about Schweitzer is when you read his biography. Read his biography, and frankly, a lot of, I mean, even though, you know, I do not agree with his conclusion of who Jesus was, he does give up everything, academia, his, and goes and serves the poor in Africa because of what he believes the message of Jesus was teaching. So let that sink in a moment. One of those things I always caution people, like, listen, make sure whoever you're critiquing doesn't out-Jesus live you. You know what I mean? It's kind of like whenever we, like, trash Gandhi, and I'm going, like, that's fine. If you don't agree with him, that's fine. But make sure then you outlive or out-Jesus live him. Especially if you're empowered by the Holy Spirit and you think that he is not, then you should have the ability to be more like Jesus than Gandhi could have ever been. So, in our criticisms, allow it at times to be a moment of self-reflection. Does that make sense? It's too easy just to cast out people and criticisms without stopping for a moment and seeing how it reflects on you. So, do I agree with Schweitzer? Absolutely not. But I do respect the way in which he took Jesus' words more seriously than, frankly, what a lot of us do that claim to have a more orthodox, objective truth of who Jesus is. Over the next 50 years, from 1906, let's do a new color. From 1906, oy, that's not a good marker. From 1906 to 1953, we have what is called the No Quest period. After Schweitzer's book, for the next 50 years, basically the quest is just dropped. It's over. And what happens during this time period is several things. There's several reasons why there is no quest, and there's several things that are happening during this time period that will lay the groundwork for a second quest, okay? During this no quest period, you have number one, they are wrestling deep with the problem of subjectivity. We're about 400 years or so into this, almost 500 years into this modernist experiment, and they're wrestling deep with the problem of subjectivity. They are looking at this as there is almost an inability to avoid presuppositions. And what does that mean? George Tyrell has this famous quote that a lot of people attribute to Schweitzer, but it isn't. It's George Tyrell. He says, "Whenever the scholar gazes into the deep well of history in search of Jesus, there is always the real hazard of seeing merely one's own reflection gazing back and mistaking that for Jesus." So this leads to a pervasive skepticism that are ever arriving at an objective picture of the historical Jesus could ever truly be accomplished. There's a skepticism that's developed during this time period that keeps it locked in a no-quest period. There's a problem of subjectivity. So how could we ever pretend to overcome that and find the true historical Jesus? Okay? Number two, there is a lack of satisfaction with Schweitzer's Jesus. During this no-quest period, one of the key tenets, too, is people are just not satisfied with the mangled body of Jesus going on the wheel of the world. They are very critical of it, and in a sense they will react pretty adversely to it, and we'll see that once we get to number four. But and Schweitzer even somewhat said that this would happen in his book. He, in a sense, predicts this. He says on page 399, so almost at the very end of his book, he says, "The study of the life of Jesus has had a curious history. It set out in quest of the historical Jesus, believing that when it found him, it could bring him straight into our time as teacher and savior. But he does not stay. He passes by our time and returns to his own. So in other words, he says, once they find the historical Jesus, they will find themselves disappointed, and he will then return back to the time from whence he came. And that's exactly what's happening during this time period. There's a lack of satisfaction with what Schweitzer's Jesus was, and so in a sense, they allow it to return back to what it was before, abandoning the quest. Number three, in this no-quest period, you see the rise of form criticism. Matter of fact, form criticism will even dominate a lot of the studies of the Gospels, led by Rudolf Bultmann. Rudolf Bultmann basically suggests that the entire notion of ever being able to recover the historical Jesus is simply impossible. The myth is too thick. Many within this understanding believe that the veil of myth separated the modern scholar from the Jesus of history and could not be recovered. It's just not possible. So Rudolf Bultmann says this in his book, Jesus and the Word. He says, quote, "I do indeed think that we can know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus. Since the early Christian sources show no interest in either, are moreover fragmentary and often legendary, and other sources do not exist." He says, why are we even trying to pursue something that is impossible? Instead, let's dive into the myth and make ourselves at home. Okay? So the rise of form criticism keeps this 50-year period in a no-quest zone, a no-quest movement. Number four, and the final one for the no-quest period, is you have the relationship of faith and history articulated, or wrestled with is probably better, not articulated, wrestled with. The relationship of faith and history. During this time, various theologians begin to attack the very foundational presuppositions that drove the first quest to begin with. That Jesus and the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history were either separate, or that the Jesus of history was something that we even needed to try and recover. People that are moving this, that are fighting against this, or wrestling with this, is Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich. They are saying that the pursuit of the historical Jesus violates the very essence of Christianity, to try to separate the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. Martin Keller actually wrote, he says, the historical Jesus of modern authors conceals from us the living Christ. Why? Because Christian faith and a history of Jesus repel each other like oil and water. They are not pursuits that can coexist. And so they abandon the pursuit altogether for 50 years. Okay? Does this make sense? Now it's time to start the second quest. I don't have a different color, so we're going back to red. Okay? The second quest begins in 1953 with a man by the name of Ernst Käsemann. Your little umlaut over the A. Käsemann. Can you guys see that? 1953. Oh. Ernst Käsemann. There is some irony in him being the one that begins, both in the location and who was present in it. Matter of fact, it's not just 1953, it is October 20th. We know the exact day that this quest launches. October 20th, 1953. Ernst Käsemann presents a lecture called The Problem of the Historical Jesus. Now, what's interesting is that he presents this paper, The Problem of the Historical Jesus, which the whole purpose of it was to critique the first quest by looking at its theological and historical difficulties, which led to its demise. But he presents it in the presence of Rudolf Bultmann. Bultmann is present. Why? Because Käsemann was one of his students. Bultmann is present, and every year, usually you'd have Bultmann, it was an annual thing, Bultmann would gather all of his students, and they would have a mini-conference of just reading papers and wrestling with thoughts together. And it was in this mini-conference of sorts that Käsemann presents this paper in the presence of someone that was adamantly against the historical Jesus movement at all. Remember, Bultmann was, it's all about the myth. What Käsemann's whole point, though, was this. He says this, quote, "We also cannot do away, though, with the identity between the exalted and the earthly Lord without falling into docetism. Now, this is fascinating. He says, conversely, neither our sources nor the insights we have gained from what has gone before permit us to substitute the historical Jesus for the exalted Lord. The clash over the historical Jesus has as its object a genuine theological problem. In other words, this is what Caseman says. The problem with the first quest was to exalt the Jesus of history over the Jesus of faith, which destroys faith completely. It's a form of taking the humanity of Jesus and allowing that to destroy the divinity of Jesus, which the creeds would have a problem with. He says, but the inverse is what we have now done. By abandoning the quest of the historical Jesus, you've allowed divinity to completely destroy his humanity, which is also an early heresy known as docetism, that Jesus is God and not truly man. He says, basically, we need to pursue the historical Jesus in order to preserve true theological union of both God and man. Yes, we can have a Jesus of faith, divinity. But we need the Jesus of history, humanity, because you cannot have one without the other unless you fall into some form of heresy. Do you understand his critique? He's saying, if we abandon the Jesus of history, we've abandoned the humanity of Jesus and have fallen into a heresy that was damned by the church hundreds of years ago. And so, Caseman suggests that a new quest should be pursued of the historical Jesus that does not intend, as Ramirez's quest, to separate the Jesus of faith and history. But to actually unite the Jesus of faith and history back where they should be together. So the second quest's impetus, the second quest's motivation, is opposite of the first quest. The first quest's motivation was to separate the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith. The second quest's motivation is to unite them, to hypostatically unify them, to bring them back together in order to preserve who Jesus truly was, both God and man. Very, very insightful criticism. And it launches a second quest. Some of the big names of the second quest include C.H. Dodd. This will probably be a question, I think. Who are some of the big names of the second quest? C.H. Dodd, D-O-D-D. Gunther Bornkamm. Bornkamm. Come to be born. Norman Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, that's another one. I mean, Edward Schillebeeks, but I am not spelling his last name because it includes an X and it's just out of control. So Norman Perrin, we'll just stick with that guy. Okay. P-E-R-R-I-N. Okay. And we'll talk about the major accomplishment of the second quest tomorrow and then end with the third quest. Love you guys. See you in the morning.